everyone. This is Space Cafe Podcast, and I am Marcus. Welcome to episode 54 of the Space Cafe Podcast. 54 is, well, not prime, obviously, but enough to allow for some pattern-seeking adventure. I love patterns, by the way. And one pattern in particular stands out. Some of the most successful guests we've had the honor of sharing the studio with based part of their success on the fact that they didn't let hecklers and critics distract them and went their way, even against the toughest headwinds. Some would even go so far as to say that you do not know you're on the right track until someone says that what you're up to is complete nonsense.
At least in English.
Anne Onislund is one of those pioneers. Together with her business partner, they found a solution to a problem that has driven even NASA to despair. A revolutionary propulsion technology that really works and that could change many things up there in orbit. A clear case for a closer look down here at the Space Cafe. What else? Welcome, Anne Onislund.
I am ready.
I really love your first name and the last name because it seems like it's almost like you crafted it. Onislund. So, of course, you didn't craft your own name, but where does it come from? Does it have a meaning?
Yes, it has a meaning. It's like in Norwegian we say Onesland, and Ones is a name, so it's the land of Ones.
Interesting.
So, now in English, when we say Onesland, it's my land.
So you have your own land already in your name. So you're free spirit.
So my name is Anne Onislund. I'm from Norway. And a physicist of origin. And now I live in France for the last 15 years. And I created, together with my co-founder, TrustMe 5 years ago. And TrustMe is a deep tech engineering company in the space industry. And we develop very innovative space propulsion systems.
You're a physicist by origin. How far back is that origin?
It feels like a lifetime ago, but it's only 5 years ago. So 5 years ago, I was a physicist and researcher at a research lab here in France. But now I'm a CEO and no longer a physicist in work. But of course, it's part of my DNA.
Do you miss being a physicist?
Not at all. I very much enjoy what I'm doing now. I'm not the person that normally misses stuff.
So just very briefly, you developed a new kind of propellant, to put that in very layperson's terms, for satellites. So to get us going, how do satellites maneuver in space at the moment?
So the traditional way, and it's still the same way as what we do, is to use propulsion. So you move a spacecraft or you change the velocity of a satellite by expelling matter, the propellant. And the better you do it, the more efficient you accelerate this propellant out, the less propellant you need to bring with you to do the same change in the orbit. So that's the basic principle of the propulsion. And now to do it very efficiently and to accelerate particles to very high velocities, normally you need gases or plasmas to accelerate charged particles. So in the past, we used gases to do that. Gases that are easy to do this ionization and accelerate these particles. What we do at TrustMe is to use a solid propellant. So it's iodine. So
is it the iodine we usually ingest against nuclear fallout issues?
Exactly. Exactly. Wow. So if there is a nuclear fallout, you should come to trust me and get saved.
So you could either propel a satellite or save my health from a nuclear fallout.
Yeah, like or you can bring it with you when you are in the forest and you have to drink water that is not clean. So then we also use iodine. So iodine is these crystals. It's the same. Mm-hmm. It's similar to salt, table salt. But what is magic about it is that when you apply a little bit of heat, it can sublimate directly to gas. So it doesn't go through the liquid phase. You know, when you have the different states of matter.
Sure.
You have a solid, you heat it up and you bring energy and it becomes a liquid. And you heat it up and it becomes a gas. And now iodine is so magical because you apply a little bit of heat and it sublimates directly to gas.
So there is no way to come up with liquid iodine.
Yes, you can do that as well, but then you need to match the pressure and the temperature. So you can also use liquid. And the whole game is to avoid using the liquid because liquid iodine is no good.
Okay.
At least for our use cases.
Okay.
So then you have a gas when you have heated it up, which means that you can use all the traditional technologies in space that used gases before. And that is what is so good about it, because you can use a solid on ground, which means that it's a passive system. You can ship it by plane. There is no pressurized gases that are in big containers containing a high pressure. And a high pressure means explosion risk, and it means expensive systems and difficult to ship. So now you have a solid. It's like you are taking your table salt and you ship it by plane. It's no risk by that. And it's the same on the launcher. There is no risk launching this system to space. And then when it is in space, it operates and it performs like in the traditional, very good systems and very efficient system.
When did you come up with that idea in the first place?
So we are not the first one to come up with this idea. Using iodine was a dream in our field for many, many years, from the 60s, because it was such an ideal propellant. But in the 60s, it was too difficult to use this matter on ground because it's also a corrosive matter. So it was abandoned for a while. And then when I started working here in France as a researcher, we had other innovative ideas of space propulsion. And one of them was to use iodine, but not in the way we do it at Trustman. It was much more complex and much more fundamental physics. We shouldn't go into it today, but it was really fundamental research at that time. And then when my co-founder, Dimitro Rafalski, came and joined me, that's when we started really looking at this propellant for the traditional space industry. And we started developing the products for that.
You know what? I'm really keen on trying to find out how you, maybe a lone researcher in Norway, can come up with a solution to something that NASA abandoned. How is that possible? Are you a genius? Of course you are.
I'm not at all a genius, and I should not take too much of this credit because it's the team at TrustMe, and especially our CTO Dimitro and the rest of the technical team that made this happen. One thing is to come up with an idea, another thing is to make it happen, and I think they did a significant work on that.
And maybe also the boldness to pursue on such an endeavor, to say, let's do it. I think this is a big part of something like this.
Let's do it. Push down the walls when people tell you it will never happen. It will never work. You will never make it happen. Because that we heard a lot, like anybody that tried to do outside of the standard mainstream. I think what we have done at TrustMe is really to go back to the basic principles of physics and engineering. And that's why we managed to make it happen before the others.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. So tell me a little bit, before we talk about the actual technology, tell me a little bit about the research. I guess it took a couple of years to come up with a solution. I could imagine that this involves quite a bit of loneliness also as a researcher. Loneliness in the lab, friction with colleagues, because it's really tough to come up with solutions. So what is life like? And don't paint a romantic picture.
I'm a romantic person, but my husband is more romantic. Yes, of course, it's a bit lonely. It's not lonely alone, because actually to make it happen, you are a team. And this has always been a teamwork, and a very strong teamwork. There is no picture of me alone in a lab trying to do something. That doesn't exist. Probably more, our city, Dimitro, had more these lonely times in the lab making it work, because he's the technical person behind the work, while I was more and is still more the one that is making everything else work around it. But for fixing technical solutions, I think that's more not my part of it. Anyway, it is a little bit lonely together, because you have to speak with people that don't believe, and also that have tried other things before and have not succeeded in the past. And why should you be bold enough to think that you will manage something other people didn't do? Without being too, it's not that we are smarter, because we are not smarter. I don't believe so. We have education, of course. We have high education like anybody else in the space industry. What we did was to think differently.
And how different?
So if we look at, now you have this very innovative propellant that I explained with, which is a solid, and it's not a pressurized system. And you shouldn't just replace this solid with, let's say that you have your whole system and you have a pressurized tank, you have all the valves that goes through the thruster itself, and there is a lot of complex things. You can't just take this part and replace it and re-engineer around it. You have to start doing the basic principles of propulsion and say, how can we use this new propellant and integrate it in another way, to use it in the best way possible?
So is this like Elon Musk's first principle thinking?
Yes, he's very famous for this first principle thinking. I think this is the basics of physics.
Okay. So
a physicist will do the basic first principle thinking. That's how we create new knowledge. And when we started working with iodine, there is a lot of new knowledge to create, because there is not a lot of literature behind how iodine react with the different surfaces. So you have to do a surface study. There is no studies on how it will be ionized. And there are many, many technologies and physics and chemistry and materials that you have to actually develop.
So that was pioneering work.
Yeah, it's pioneering. It's really research, back to create knowledge. And you have to couple that with engineering work to make it work and make it a product, because that's two different things. A physicist is very good in asking questions and maybe getting a solution, but the engineers are there to make it work and make it happen.
And come up with answers. So what's your secret sauce to making people support that project, to find people to not oppose and say the usual thing, that's not going to happen, that's impossible, NASA couldn't do it, why should you do it? So what's your secret sauce behind it?
I think we are all a little bit optimistic and naive in a way that we and everybody that we recruit have this open-mindedness. So you can see that it's a very diverse team, but the common point with all the people we recruit are that they are very, very curious. And they have moved countries and continents before. They are not scared of being outside of their comfort zone. It's actually their comfort zone. And this makes you curious about other things, and therefore you can work with people that know other things that you do. And that's how you can get a teamwork to make things happen.
I found a team photo of your company on the internet, and what stood out to me was the atmosphere that that team radiated into my direction. It seems like they like working with one another. That photo has a true team spirit.
Yeah, I think teamwork is and the team spirit, and what that means is that you have to trust each other, and you have to believe in each other. It doesn't mean that you need to be agreeing all the time or that it's all the time pleasant. Sure. But actually, good teamwork is when you can dare to not agree and you can dare to be yourself and think in the way you think and accept the other ones to do the same thing.
I like that. So it's you allow yourself to be open because the others are open. So it's a team of trust held together by trust. And I think this is, and trust means it's okay to make failures because by making failures, we learn, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And it's okay to say, I'm not so strong in this part. Can you help me? Or I'm blocked here, or this is my weak spot, or here I'm strong. And it's also good to say, I'm good at that part. I can do it.
So at some point, after meticulous work and lonely hours in the lab, at some point you decided you have something that could work. What next?
So Dimitri and I, we actually came up with we started working on miniaturization of propulsion in 2014. Before that, we had worked on other topics together since 2011. So we worked quite a long time together. And we were at a conference in the US in 2014 or 15. And we listened to the large corporates speaking about the new space and how they would tackle the situation. And we realized that we had something. We had something that we could do to improve and to help the industry. And then we went back and started our first business plan on a sheet of paper and said, we can do something like this. And then it's you start to have to get other people with you. You have to get funding to recruit engineers. In the past, you would recruit physicists for PhDs, and now we need to recruit engineers. And you have to set up and prepare to spin out this technology into a startup, if that was what we wanted to do. So in the beginning, it was really to find out the strategy. Are we going to work with a big corporate? Are we going to get a research contract and continue R&D? Are we going to do a spin out to a startup? And finally, we decided to do the spin out because it's really exciting and we got really, and we have something to bring to the industry. And it took us, up to 2017 to create the company.
So was the industry waiting, desperately waiting for your development, for your invention, or were you facing unexpected opposition and disbelief in the beginning?
In the beginning, actually what is funny is that when we came and started talking with the potential clients, they would tell us that they would never use electric propulsion because they didn't have the power enough on the satellite or the satellite was too small or or many other, we don't need propulsion. And we continued and said, this will never continue. They will change their minds because it doesn't make sense. And their power budget will be higher and they will need better deployment of their constellation. So it's for sure that every single satellite will need propulsion on board to be economically sustainable. Doesn't make sense if not. And also to have a sustainable use of space, you need propulsion on board. So we continued. And when our products were finished and ready, then also the industry is ready. So we are really in the good timing.
Fascinating. But it seems like in the beginning, if you're onto something, expect pushback. This is what also was so true for you. So
yeah,
if there's pushback, you know, maybe we're on the right track.
Yeah, true.
Nice, nice, nice. So, okay.
I take always that as a compliment when people don't believe.
Great, great. By the way, with that new thruster technology, were you approaching primarily European industries, European partners, or were you pushing for all over the place and finding out who would be the right partner, or was Europe the first target?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And it's a quite interesting answer I have to give, because what we were looking for was the innovators in the satellite manufacturing industry. Those that are ready to go first. Because when we are coming with a new product, it's always a risk. And you can never assure enough saying it's going to work, because you can't say that. Because it's not sure that it's going to work. And it's not sure that it's safe for your satellite before you have tested it. So when we speak with the European actors, what is the typical feedback is, it's extremely interesting. We want to do it. Let's do an application to ESA and get funding and da-da-da-da-da. And it would be maybe 2 years before we would have anything in space. So the European actors were just definitely interested, but too slow in the movement. They wouldn't take action and the risk themselves as a commercial action. For the Americans, it was a little bit similar. Why should they do it when Europeans don't? While the Chinese are much more in the innovative moment now, it really moves Quark Company, Space T, for the first two missions, because they were ready to do innovation and they were ready to take the risk. It comes with the big achievements if it goes well. So they were not afraid. And it was really something very interesting to observe, because the Europeans were just too afraid to innovate quickly enough.
To work with the Chinese, because from very often you hear that China would then use that as a way to bring technologies for their own needs. Were there any issues with that? Were you thinking, hey, should we do that? Shouldn't we do it? Will they in their own hands and take it away from us?
Yeah, of course, you have to be very, very careful in such a move. I think it would be the same if we went to the US or same if we went to... You have to be very careful for copying such an innovative product. We got a lot of support from the French state to help us in towards working with China and the Chinese actors. And we also chose very carefully the first client in China. So Space T, for example, have now an office in Luxembourg. So now it is a European Chinese company. And the culture in that company is understanding the Western culture. The discussions with them are less complicated than we tried to do with some others that are very, very Chinese, where language became a barrier. While with Space T, it was not really a language barrier, maybe also a little bit of a culture barrier, but there were many people in that company in China that had been away for their studies in either Europe or in Canada. And that helped us a lot, and we still have a very good collaboration with them.
So what was the first cooperation with China like? So they helped you test that thruster technology in actual space.
Yeah, so we have two different technologies using iodine at the moment, and we have different technologies that we are developing and products that are coming up in the near future. But the first technology that we tested was in 2019. It's called a coal gas thruster with iodine. It's the simplest system that you can find now on the market. And for Space Tea, that was not of their interest because their platforms mm-hmm. are bigger and they need something mm-hmm. more performant. Mm-hmm. But it was the leading up to our next much higher performance system that they would need for their constellation. So it was a win-win. The first one was for us to test the demo, the technology and make sure that it works. And the second was to test a technology and a product that they would be interested in after. So it's really a win-win collaboration of demonstrating technologies that the industry and mm-hmm. they would need later. Mm-hmm.
So ThrustMe is your company name, the brand name of your proprietary technology. By the way, who came up with that brilliant name? This is genius. Seriously, ThrustMe can't get any better.
Thank you. So I came up with that idea. And
so you are a genius.
Thank you. And okay. I came and asked first Dimitro, what do you think about that name? We had many other names, and every day we came with new names, and and then I said, Diva, what do you think about trust me? Brilliant. That's it. And then I started Googling it, and we realized that it's maybe a bit difficult to call that company mm-hmm. this because of the sexual connotation in English. Mm-hmm. And then I called my brother-in-law, which is mm-hmm. American, and I asked mm-hmm. him, can I call the company Trust Me? And his answer was, no, I'm no. crazy. No. And yeah, but is it very, very bad or is it pink? It's pink. And, okay, that is done. We call it
Great. That's but really brilliant.
Sometimes it's a bit complicated, but we see that some journalists have a problem writing our name in the title, but yeah. That's okay.
Yeah. Sometimes it's beneficial if there's a little bit of talk about something like a brand name. It's it's beneficial sometimes.
Yeah. So it's deliberate, absolutely. It's not something that we did without knowing.
Nicely played. So how can I, as a layperson, imagine your technology? So, for example, I could imagine if I had a regular rocket thruster, a miniature version right next to me on my table, and I would turn it on, I would immediately see the results. It would burn down my table and would burn down my house and whatnot. What would happen if I activated your ThrustMe drive right next to me on the table?
Nothing. It wouldn't work. For this very high in-orbit propulsion systems, you need vacuum for them to work. So you need a big vacuum chamber for it mm-hmm. to actually turn on. So mm-hmm. it wouldn't turn on. It would just burn its own electronic circuit and be destroyed.
Okay.
So you would be very disappointed.
Okay. Yeah, totally. So, but this is kind of interesting because how can you demo something like this on Earth to get investment?
Yeah, so we have, our labs are quite impressive because we have big vacuum chambers to test these systems in space or simulate them and test them and develop them. What is interesting with our technology and the use of iodine is that pumping systems to make big this vacuum and the vacuum chambers are not the same as when you use gaseous systems. You cannot use the same pumps to make vacuum. So this is something we had to also study a lot and master and to deal with this technology and develop it.
Are those drives as powerful as traditional gaseous drives in space? So would the acceleration be the same or would it be different?
Yeah, what we showed with our demonstration in space is that it's actually giving better performances than the classical system.
So it's your space Tesla.
So it's a space Tesla. It's even better and better for the planet and better for the operations.
In how far is it better?
Yeah, so it's if we compare it with the classical xenon systems, it's slightly better. Measurably better, but not a factor of two better. It's just a little bit better. But when it comes to Krypton, which Elon Musk is using on the Starlink, you need two times more power to generate the same force. So that is significantly better. It's two times more. And also the iodine stores 9 times denser than Krypton. So if we compare to the Starlink satellites. So the space that you will gain and also the cost of the iodine is significantly better. So iodine is around 50 euro per kilo, even below if you buy a lot. While xenon before the 24th of February was 2,500 euro a kilo. So iodine is only 2% the cost. And since the war in Ukraine, the xenon prices have tripled.
Wow. Wow. This sounds like almost too good to be true. Are you a very rich person now?
Absolutely not. no, it's you know, when you do groundbreaking innovation, which I think this is, the advantages are many, because it's so groundbreaking and and it's not easy to make. We still have a long way to go. At the moment, we have products, that have, low power, use. So it's for the smaller satellites. The next step is to develop systems for bigger platforms. And there is definitely more R&D to do and things to cover.
Would that be something to seriously consider for manned missions? For example, Mars missions. Would that be something that Elon could be interested in, or whoever is going to Mars
these days?
So is that something?
So for when you go to Mars, for the crew, for the persons, you need to do it quicker. And then you need chemical propulsion or much higher system, a higher force to move faster. But for all the cargo that will go there, and all the systems and all the materials and the stuff can use more time. And it's definitely using electric propulsion. And it's definitely using iodine because there is no xenon or krypton that we should really send so much out there because we need it here on the ground.
I still like the idea that I could get the iodine tablets in my pharmacy and at the same time drive your ingenious thrusters to go from wherever I want to go. So that's pretty cool. So it's very sustainable.
True. It's very sustainable.
So tell me, that moment when for the first time your technology, your thrust me drive was in space, in orbit, and you hit the activate thrust now button. How was that? Tell me that moment.
It's so we did the launch in from China during the COVID period, so we couldn't even be there to integrate mm-hmm. and help Space T to integrate. So everything was a bit of stress because we did all the information via Zoom or other mm-hmm. applications. And we also made video recordings. So we were mm-hmm. made sure that they didn't have to be lost in translation by reading. So we did a lot of videos to make sure that they integrated the system properly. And then when it launched, of course, we couldn't be there at the launch. So we got video streams from China to see it. It's quite
it's nerve-wracking, isn't it? It's I mean, like it's your baby on board.
Yeah. So that's a stressful period. And then you have to wait because then it's all the commissioning of the satellite and you don't know exactly when it's your turn. And suddenly you get a phone call and said, okay, you have to be ready. And it can be a Sunday morning and I think for us, it was a Sunday morning when we should first fire it up. And it's quite a.
And everything worked as James Webb. To me, James Webb is the new standard for perfection. So it
worked.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Just the way James Webb was working.
So everything worked as what we expected. Not everything. It was still a tech demonstration. So mm-hmm. We learned a lot from that mission. And mm-hmm. we, according to all the success criteria that we had defined beforehand, it outperformed what we expected from this mission. Wow. But there is still a lot of things to develop and a lot of things to improve, of course. It's the first demonstration. And now we have different systems in space and we are delivering to clients. And we still continue improving the system. I think you never end improving mm-hmm. a system. It's a continuous process.
Wow. And how do you motivate yourself to move on? I mean, like, it seems like this is, you already mentioned, it's sometimes very stressful, sometimes very lonely, sometimes maybe you're doubting if you're on the right track, but it seems like you're always making the right decision. So what's your secret sauce? How do you motivate yourself to move on?
That's a good question. Are you doing sport? Are you a player?
Yes. I do ultra running, mountain running.
Ah, yes. Okay. So I'm a bit too. Not ultra. So I've always been a very competitive person. I did a lot of athleticism when I was young and I'm used to compete. And I think healthy competition is always a good motivation. Mm-hmm. And you can compete with yourself or you can compete with others. But to have some goals of reaching and competing against your own performances mm-hmm. or we should admit that working towards the first test of iodine system in space and we knew that there were other people on the planet working on it as well, of course it gives a drive to push further and faster. Mm. It's always good to have good and healthy competition.
Hmm. What would you tell to all those who are not into sports and still want to be a good engineer, a good physicist, a good inventor of new technologies?
I think those are even more. They have to compete in this field. So I think we all find, well, either you have your competitive edge and drive, or you will not do it because there is no reason. So I think everybody that really push through and work hard, it's to demonstrate something. And it's to demonstrate something for yourself or to others. And for example, when you hear in 2008, when I first spoke about iodine to use iodine in space, the comments I got were, oh, very interesting physics, but this will never work. It will never happen. And this wish to show them wrong is a very strong drive. And other people can take it as a pushback and say, okay, maybe I should listen to them. And I unfortunately have this thing of, I will prove them wrong very strongly. And this is good. And it's also sometimes I have to work on that too. I admit that maybe they were right this time.
Is your family proud of you, I guess? A tough mom pushing frontiers?
Yes, but I think also it's my role to be proud of my kids and not the the opposite way around. But of course.
What else in Anne's world that is not space related? What is it that you love doing? You said it's sports. Do you permanently watch space movies, science fiction movies, because this is your world?
No, not yes and no. I like science fiction movies are cool. What I like to do is to be outdoor. And to be in the mountains, So now next week I'm going up in the Arctic for an exploration with my family. So this is what I like to do when I'm not doing the space.
Wow, fascinating! So is this like an outdoor experience?
For example, last week I went camping in the forests with the tent and backpacks.
But it's winter.
Even if I live in Paris. So you can do that not so far from Paris. But yeah, it's nice to be outside in the forest. Or in the mountains or on the ocean.
So this is your way to ground yourself and to balance your life out from very tough work leading a company and to recharge your own batteries, I guess.
Yes, for sure. And every year, I'm really a fan of getting off the grid. It's really off the grid. So turning off the phone, turning off the electricity, water, and be 10 days on autosufficiency in the mountains with the family, where you bring everything with you. And so we normally go in the Arctic once a year. We can cross 150 kilometers on ski and pulling 40 kilos of weight behind us to just be...
and seriously,
the mega constellations are not there yet, so we don't have phone connections. You can't reach us.
Not yet.
Not yet.
But how do you motivate your kids to come along? I mean, seriously, I have two daughters. They would never, ever come along in something like this.
They were 18 months the first time we brought them in the camp. So they don't know anything different. So they are used
really?
To that. And you know, when you see kids when they are very small, they have at least mine are very, very active. So they would never stop, and they are twins. So you have you have to make them do sport, because if not, you will just go insane in a small apartment in Paris. So you have to train so they get used to it.
Resilience.
Yes.
Speaking of kids, what would you tell young adults, why the space industry is a fascinating place to work?
I think young adults or very young kids or any is that it's extremely fascinating because there are so many domains that need to be covered. So you can always find a place in the space industry where you have something that you can bring. Either it's because you are very good in engineering. But there is not only engineering, it's physics, it's materials, you have humans, you need to run the businesses, you need finance. Mm-hmm. So you don't need only to have the hard sciences to be in the space. But another thing that we should also keep in mind is that the hard sciences is a very bad word, because it looks like it's very tough. And we tend to use these words that makes us scared.
The usual triggers, math and physics, and I'm not good enough, and
And we get scared of them, and I can see that sometimes in social settings, that when you say that you are a physicist, people get a bit scared of you. And I think this is something that we need to break down, because I don't think we are that much smarter.
That's good to hear. I guess you were pretty smart at school in math and physics, but what were you not so good at?
I'm a very strong dyslexic person. So I could not read and write before I was 10 years old.
Wow, interesting.
So I had to do everything by memory, so teachers didn't discover it. Wow. So I had to memorize most of the text until I was 10 years, because I was too slow in reading it when it was my turn to read.
Wow. So what you're saying is that the space industry is looking for any kind of expertise. So even if you're not really like super excelling at math and physics and the typical disciplines you would connect with the space industry, there is still a place for you, because if you can do something in the social sciences, for example, there will be a place for you in the space industry.
Yeah, I think so. Of course, there is a dominance of engineers and physicists, sure, and you need to like to work with these kind of people. Sure. But there is always a need for a diversity. And I think it will come more and more, what you can see in other sectors as well.
What is it like to work in Europe as opposed to the United States, as opposed to China?
I don't know. I've not been long enough working in US or in China to really have the experience. But what you can see is that I think we have a stronger work-life balance. In a startup, that is maybe not the truth, but but in general, it's the truth that we have a better work-life balance.
Mm-hmm. Good. It's good to hear. So what up next in Anne Lund's world? So what up next in your TrustMe world?
Yeah, so it's a quite exciting time at TrustMe, because now we have started the industrialization. So we have just started renting our next door building to set up the whole infrastructure for industrialization and the production line. We have just recruited our head of production. We have recruited a CFO, and now we are recruiting up to 15 people this year. So now we are growing, and it's the next step of the company, where we are serving clients internationally. So it's an interesting period, from going to from R&D and product development, and now it's really in the industrialization and delivery to clients.
Wonderful.
While we keep also developing other products and the next products that comes to other markets.
Cool. Is there a secret product you would like to talk about?
Of course.
I'm just asking. Okay. And you know what, since you just mentioned that you're listening to a Space Cafe podcast while running, you know what the last question is.
Yes.
And the last question is the one about coffee. Do you drink coffee?
I drink far too much coffee.
good. Because the last question is all about the Space Cafe espresso. And that would be your inspiration, your espresso for the mind you would like to share with me, with the audience, when it comes to something off the top of your head you think is inspiring to audiences and could inspire audiences out there to lead better lives in the future, either personally or socially or whatnot. You can pick any kind of topic.
Any kind of topic. So I think it's maybe not to live better lives, but many of my heroes are explorers to the Arctic and the Antarctic. And during the COVID time, we had a Norwegian and South African person crossing the North Pole on skis during night. And to be able to cross the North Pole, what they had to do was to change their rhythm the 24-day rhythm to 27-day, 27 hours instead of 24 hours, to be able to cope with the sliding of the ice while they walk. So they worked and the ice would slide while they slept. So to be able to do it, they had to create 27-hour stays. And this is what I'm dreaming of now, because in startups, we never have enough hours in a day. so the result is that we should have 27-hour stays instead of 24, and we can do much better.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Anne, for that very inspiring conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Marcus. Thank you for having me.
It's never too late to dare doing what was previously deemed impossible. Times change, and so does the potential for solutions. What an inspiring message to get us through times of frustration and despair. Yes, these are the very words we should unabashedly say more often. Life can be hard and frustrating, and perhaps most of the time it is. But those brief moments of triumph after overcoming a big problem are worth every second, right? Thank you for spending your valuable time with us today. Stay tuned. Bye-bye.